Thank you for having me. And I remember fondly the times I've been here, various programs at the ITP. And so I'm going to talk about my particular point of view on black hole evaporation, information paradox, and so on. I've put a paper on the archive that, that last June, which discusses a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, though my views have evolved somewhat from then, not a whole lot, not drastically. And so the basic framework I'm going to assume, well, first, I know many of you like to use H bar equal 1. I like to use G equal C equal 1. And I find it useful, at least in forms of my thoughts, to then use the Planck mass as a unit, and explicitly rather than just implicitly. And of course, H bar is in the Planck squared. And now I'm really only going to talk about very large black holes in this area. I'm not going to worry about some sort of Planck scale thing. I'm going to talk about very large even astrophysical black holes, which are formed by gravitational collapse of a star or something similar. And for the purposes of the information paradox, I'm going to assume we start from a pure quantum state in the initial, before the collapse. And now I'm going to be discussing, my point of view is that given these circumstances with some very, very large black hole, that one should be able to think of what's going on as a generalistic space-time with quantum corrections. Okay. Now, and I'm, again, for simplicity, I'm going to assume spherical symmetry for the space-time. Though, of course, the quantum fields will not be spherical symmetric in general, but that the overall space-time is spherical. And R is the spherical radius, 4 pi r squared is the area of a two-sphere. And then, of course, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is then goes as the area of the horizon divided by the Planck constant or divided by mp squared. And for one solar mass, this is the order of 10 to the 77. So, and 1 over this is basically the semi-classical expansion parameter. I'm talking about the effect of quantum quantum fields on this background, on the back reaction on the space-time. So and now it's usually this, I consider this entropy is the maximum possible von Neumann entropy of the black hole. Now of course this is disputed by some people, but has nothing to do with the actual number of quantum degrees of freedom, either on the horizon or in the black hole interior, though in certain limits it may be equal. And of course, the Hawking temperature, you know, the Hawking radiation has a temperature TH, which goes as mp squared over m, basically, and kappa is the surface gravity of the black hole. Now. Okay, now just to be a little provocative, I'm going to say what I can talk about a few myths, which are often that I consider as myths, which you sometimes see stated in the literature. Now, first is that Hawking radiation is created very close to the horizon, within sort of a, the order of a Planck length of the horizon. And I would argue that what one finds from the semi-classical analysis is that this is far from being the truth, that they're actually created on, through quantum coherence over scales of the order of m, and that the myth is that they're created close to the horizon and propagate out and are partially reflected by the barrier in the propagation of waves around Article 3M, this difficult barrier, or the even for zero Agamemnon, there is still a barrier. It's higher for higher Agamemnon waves. So another myth is that Hawking radiation is in any sense strongly S-wave dominated. Not that S-waves don't play a substantial role, but that they're dominated by S-waves. And this is clearly the case if you consider that the known zero mass fields that would contribute to Hawking radiation from a very large black hole have non-zero spin. There's photons and gravitons. And a non-zero spin field cannot have an S wave, at least as a single particle. So, dimension reduction to 2D near the horizon of a 4D black hole, I think, is not a valid way of deriving properties of the Hawking radiation. Again, some papers try to do this, and with some famous names. I mean, for instance, Freak and Wilczek wrote a paper talking about pair creation, or rather quantum tunneling through the horizon over a Planck-like sort of scale, which I consider not valid. And also there's a paper by Robinson and Wilczek, which did this two-dimensional reduction to try to relate the Hawking radiation to the sort of general covariance anomaly of a 2D gravitational field. Yeah?
Since you mentioned the Parkey-Wilczek paper, is there a specific mistake you can point to? Like, they do get the right answer, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, people have derived the Hawking radiation some infinite number of ways, right? And they all get the same answer in the sort of large black hole limit. So the fact they get the right answer, I don't think is particularly compelling one way or the other. So one issue, which I may come back to later, is that when you talk about the gravitational potential energy of a particle or something, that's basically non-local in general relativity. Now, for spherical symmetry, you can localize it in a certain sense in spherical shells, but it's basically non-local. And then to try to use the gravitational potential energy of a particle just inside the horizon and it's changed the tunnels through the horizon, I think violates this sort of non-locality of gravitational potential energy. But anyway.
There's a different argument that hasn't maybe been done in its entirety carefully, but you can make a partial wave decomposition of whatever field you're considering.
Right.
And treat a partial wave like partial wave. Again, there are some things that haven't been cleared up, but you think there are some things.
But again, they rely on going to the near horizon limit to get a 2D reason to 2D.
No, I think you would have an effective potential for each partial wave.
Yeah, well.
Whether or not you have.
Right, you have an effect, and certainly each partial wave, I mean, in terms of driving Hawking radiation, you do it partial wave by partial wave, basically. And so it's certainly true that, you know, that's important for the derivation. I don't think you have anything you can really call a particle until you're well outside the horizon. I'll come back to this.
Anyway.
Following up on that point, your myth number one is that really a well-defined. There's not a well-defined question, which is, people have made a mistake on it. As you say, particles aren't defined very close to the horizon, so it's sort of ambiguous what you mean by Hawking radiation there.
Right, so I would claim you don't really have Hawking radiation until you get out to R of the order of 3M. And you'll see why I say that. I mean, I'm not saying that these are you know, necessarily final truths. It's just that it's my point of view.
There's a sharp version of that, I think, and that is an infalling detector will see Hawking radiation down to about there, and then we'll stop seeing really Hawking radiation.
They certainly see radiation. You're saying infalling detectors stop then.
Once they get within our, the border R.
This radio spectrum is not precisely thermal.
Well, no, I'll discuss this later in the talk.
Show you the stress tensor.
But,
it's not stress
tensor, it's a question. So there's certainly unradiation, but I don't consider that a property of the black hole. I consider it a property of the detector, so in that sense.
That's why I said freely modeled.
And that's the last point. Anyway, the other is that black holes, the quantum system, has a number of states equal to the exponential of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and is thermalized on a so-called fast scrambling time of order m log m. And that again, that's certainly been a point of view that's been promoted by some famous people, but we'll see that, you know, I don't consider that the right way of thinking about black holes. But anyway, and also the idea of storing large...
You started off by saying you're considering a pure state.
Right.
So don't we know from the beginning, unless you are promulgating a new myth, that the entropy is one?
Well, so initially the entropy is zero, right? But then as you... Well, say you have a collapsing star, which is entangled with something, some distant part of the universe.
When you're discussing, you're referring to this pure state.
So initially the entropy is zero. I claim the entropy for a long time is still small compared to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. If you, by that you mean the number of states that are excited above vacuum. The number of degrees of freedom that are excited. But anyway. So now the outline then is my basic point of view is I'm going to take seriously the semi-classical analysis of the energy momentum tensor on a Schwarzschild background and interpret it physically. I'm not doing any new calculations, just reinterpreting old calculations. And with particular attention to the conformal anomaly as sort of a separate part of the energy momentum tensor, conserved separately from the rest. And we'll see this involves a certain decomposition of the energy momentum tensor, which is different from what people did in actually setting up the calculations in these sort of classic papers in the late 70s. But it's just reinterpretation, not anything new in terms of results. Okay, now the key point I'm going to emphasize here is that I want to consider the evolution of the black hole geometry as the result of quantum back reaction, both inside and outside the horizon. And this leads to the information paradox, the question of unitarity versus causality, because there's no causal way of getting information out of the interior of the black hole, but the upshot is, I agree, and sort of everybody I think agrees that there's some need for some sort of new physics by the Planck time, which is when the von Neumann entropy of the black hole is equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Now I'm going to argue for that this quantum back reaction, in the standard semi-classical theory, this quantum back reaction is very small, essentially at all times until you get the black hole shrinks down to the Planck scale, at the outer horizon, right? I'm going to argue that there is some sort of hidden assumptions there. There are some hidden assumptions there, which I think aren't necessarily true. And it's possible that there could be a very large Glenbeck reaction eventually. And these arguments are based on the Busseau covariant entropy bound. And then I'm going to give you a sort of a very rather crude toy model for how I think a black hole might evolve based on these ideas. I mean, it's not meant to be any sort of rigorous result, but just and it's based on an ansatz for the metric in the black hole interior, a simple ansatz, and then I'll discuss some possible endpoints for the black hole evaporation, which include complete dispersal, in other words, no event horizon, all trap surfaces disappear by the page time, and or some sort of massive remnant or slowly evaporating massive remnant. Okay, so now to get to the details. Now the semi-classical energy momentum tensor has been calculated for a Schwarzschild background outside the horizon for both massless spin zero and spin one fields. It has not been calculated. I mean, the Hawking radiation has been calculated, but not the full energy momentum tensor for spin two fields or, you know, gravitons. Now, to discuss the physics, then I'm going to think in terms of the physical components in a static frame. This is outside the horizon now, and where you can define a static frame. And in that frame, the energy, a local classical observer would measure an energy density, which is minus the TT, mixed TT component of the energy momentum tensor. There's an energy flux, F, a radial stress, P sub R, and a transverse stress, P sub T. And that's all there is in terms of independent components, given the assumption of circle symmetry. And there are two conservation equations, energy and momentum. And if we assume that the, at least to some good approximation, the energy tensor outside the black hole is stationary on a dynamical time scale. Of course, it's changing on an evaporation time scale. But on a dynamical time scale, it's essentially stationary. And the energy conservation is just a divergence of this energy flux with appropriate geometrical corrections equal to zero. And then you have a momentum conservation equation, which relates the gravitational acceleration, which is basically this M over R term, to radial driven involving the radial stress and the transverse stress. And finally, according to the standard semi-classical theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is given in terms of the background geometry. And for a Schwarzschild, it's just 48 m squared over r to the sixth. And with coefficients, which are different for different spins. And for spin zero, it's the way the formula is normalized. For spin zero, it's one. Spin one, it's minus 13. And for spin two, it's 212. And now, an important, of course, point in step in all this is to say what your quantum state is, right? Now, I said I want to assume a pure state, which is essentially the Minkowski vacuum, long before the black hole forms. And now, the standard arguments that this, when you translate this into the black hole, after the black hole sort of settles down after its formation, and again for circle symmetry, that so-called Unruh vacuum is the appropriate state, which can be translated into boundary conditions on waves at past null infinity. So you want no incoming radiation at past null infinity, and you want the energy momentum to be regular on the future horizon. And this is there have been arguments that this is what you expect from something that's initially the Minkowski vacuum. And then you have a formation of the black hole, there's some transients, and then you settle down to this sort of state in terms of describing the fields in the vicinity of the black hole. Now, and what one finds then is for each spin field, each field of a given spin S, that you have the famous Hawking energy flux, which is given by that formula with coefficients which decrease with increasing spin, as opposed to the formula which increases, and the coefficients originally calculated by Page, and sigma is just the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. All right. Now, okay. Now, what I consider a physically appropriate way of decomposing the energy tensor is, since one's talking about, you know, basically Hawking radiation going out more, you know, roughly radially, and then that you can, and this is a general, for any strict cosmetic energy tensor, you can decompose it into a radially outgoing null fluid, so everything's just propagating radially, a radially ingoing null fluid, and the difference between the two is the sign relationship between the energy flux and the energy density. So outgoing, they're same sign, ingoing, they're opposite sign. And then because things aren't perfectly, everything isn't propagating regularly, and there's some other corrections, there's a sort of a residual, which I define, you know, take a traceless residual, P residual, for which the radial stress is equal to minus the energy density, which is something that is the condition which guarantees Lorentz invariance for boosts in the radial direction, not in general in the transverse direction, but in the radial direction. And because it's being, so that plus it's traceless means there's just 1 degree of freedom there, which you can take to the energy density if you like. And finally, there's this conformal anomaly piece, or the part related to the trace of the energy minimum tensor. And now, of course, the conformal anomaly doesn't tell you, it just tells you the value of the trace. It doesn't tell you anything about any component of the energy minimum tensor that's related, you know, that gives you that, that has that trace. Now, but I think there are good reasons to say that that component, you could think of that as a separate component, and as I look at the results, I'll, you can see why. But it's a component for which the radial stress is minus 1/2 times the transverse stress and is minus the energy density. So again, it's invariant under radial boost. And then for that form, you want the radial stress to be 1/2 the trace of the energy minimum tensor. So that that is the only contribution to the trace of the energy minimum tensor, if you assume that. Now, the fraction of the energy flux that's ingoing, because it's, as we'll see, it's not purely outgoing as you get close to the horizon, it's ingoing, is I'll call it S of X. And so then the F out is 1 minus F times the total flux, and F in is F times the total flux. And what that means is that if F is positive, then the and less than 1, then you have a positive energy density going out, but you have a negative energy density going in, because remember the energy density for ingoing is minus the flux. Yeah. So, okay, so far. So I define what I consider the conformal anomaly piece of the energy minimum tensor by those relations. Now, again, you know, calculating the conformal anomaly does not tell you that that's the proper thing to do.
That's right.
But I'll try to explain. Well, why I think it is the proper thing to do. Basically, this is what gives you that the conformal anomaly. So given that definition, then you, with the Schwarzschild conformal anomaly, one of our other six, that is a, that satisfies the constraint equations, particularly the momentum constraint equation. So in that sense, what I'm basically assuming then is that the conformal anomaly is separate from the rest of the that part of the instrument tensor is dynamically separate from the rest of the instrument tensor. And I think that's reasonable because the conformal anomaly does not, is something that just depends on the background of geometry. It doesn't depend on the quantum state. And so it's hard to see how it could be any dynamical connection between the conformal anomaly part and the part that does depend on the quantum state, which gives rise to the Hawking radiation.
A question about the ingoing part. So you said there's a non-zero ingoing part. If I think about this in 1 + 1 dimension, where it's really cleanest, then at least one way of phrasing that is you have, say, left movers that are ingoing, and you really have nothing ingoing at infinity.
So the matter condition is the F sub S, in other words, should go to zero at infinity. At the right infinity in the 1 + 1 case.
Square minus.
Square minus, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, but how does that match up with you just stated there is an infinity plus.
Well, there's near the horizon.
These
are not dynamically separate. These are not dynamically separate. There's quantum dynamics going on, which is creating this inward flux.
Yeah, okay. It's not an asymptotic flux.
Okay. So now, the conditions that things behave nicely at infinity, so you just have outgoing Hawking radiation at null infinity, and at future null infinity, and that and no, nothing incoming at past null infinity, and that things be regular in the horizon means that this F sub S has to satisfy this first equation here, right? See that? Where H sub S is something that's regular both at x equals, so H sub S is something that's, doesn't blow up or do anything funny at either at infinity or on the horizon. And again, I won't try to go into the details of that, but it's easily verified that that's the case. And then given that form for H sub S, and so far everything is general except for the boundary conditions, but we haven't, the actual calculation of the instrument tensor involves basically calculating S sub S. And then this residual then from the momentum constraint equation can be calculated, and you get something that involving these integrals, and then a constant of integration, d sub s. And d sub s you can think of as telling you how well readily collimated the radiation is at large r. Or in other words, what is the, if you're looking backward at the black hole, how big is, what's the distribution, angular distribution of radiation around the, that you see coming from the vicinity of the black hole? Of course, you don't see it all coming radially, it's coming partly from the side. And as I said, this decomposition and this way of formulating things is not what was actually done in doing the numerical calculations, but it's a reformulation. But basically, you can think of the numerical calculations as determining this function h sub s of x and the constant d sub s. And that has to be done by mode sums over all the, for the particular spin field that you're considering. And this was done by Elster, spin zero, Jensen, McLaughlin, and Otto Wilf for spin one, that has not been done for spin two. Now, it turns out for spin zero, Visser showed that you can get a very accurate analytic approximation to the numerical results by just essentially just by setting this H sub s equal to a constant C sub s. And this is, and for spin zero, this is accurate to, you know, sort of 1% in terms of the as a function of radius. Now for spin one, unfortunately, because as you'll see, that the way the results were presented were just in some very crudely drawn graphs, and in such a way, combining things in such a way that the conformal anomaly sort of dominates things. So anything, of course, S of S has nothing to do with the conformal anomaly, and so it's hard to say anything very accurately about what, in terms of this decomposition, about what numerical results actually were, without going back to the original calculations, which I haven't tried to do. But the same simple choice of just H sub s equal constant is, I'm trying to do the best I can from looking at the graphs, is maybe accurate to 10 to 20% for spin one. And spin two, who knows? no claim. But basically what I'm going to do is assume that this simple approximation, analytic approximation, is at least qualitatively, you know, more or less right. And certainly quantitatively it's quite good for spin zero. Now,
correct all this is just assuming the geometry is fixed.
So it's assuming fixed Schwarzschild geometry, right?
And
no back reaction. Just quantum fields as test fields and a Schwarzschild background. Okay. Now, so now I give you this little table where I'm evaluating the energy densities associated with each component of the energy MEM tensor that I talked about on the horizon, you know, the horizon, the social horizon, in units of sigma th to the fourth, and in a frame that's freely falling from infinity. Now, in a static frame is singular on the horizon because it corresponds to observers moving at the speed of light. And unless you have a very special sort of vacuum type energy momentum tensor, if you give an infinite boost to that energy momentum tensor, you get infinite components. So you really have to consider things in a freely falling frame. And now, of course, there's no particular reason why you should choose the frame that's falling from rest to infinity. But for that case, then you get these, well, so that you have the coefficients, the Hawking radiation coefficients, the conformal anomaly coefficients, which I've given you before, and then the values of C sub s that give a good fit in the zero case and seem to give roughly the right sort of fit for the spin one case, and, you know, and the 25 is just taking the same ratio as 25 to 3.8 is 3.8 to 0.54 roughly. But you can see that in this particular frame that you have positive energy densities for the outgoing part on the horizon, negative energy densities for the ingoing part, and then the residual is sort of blah, and then the conformal anomaly. And one thing I want to emphasize here is that by the time you get to spin two, the conformal anomaly is just vastly greater than anything reasonable that you could reasonably expect for the other components. Okay, so, again, you know, if you were to show, say, a frame freely falling not from infinity, but say some large 3m, that would correspond to dividing the E out by a factor of 3 and multiplying the E in by a factor of 3. And the closer you get, freely falling from closer and closer to the event horizon, the, the ingoing negative energy radiation is enhanced by a larger and larger factor. And if you get close enough, free fall from close enough to the event horizon, but still a macroscopic distance away, you can have the net energy density being negative. for the, well, okay. So these are the results for this function S of X. And again, spin zero is, I think, really good for X. Now, so this is plotted as a function of 2 over R. So the outside of the black holes is X less than 1. And the calculations only extend as far as X equal 1. And the curves beyond that are just analytic continuations of the analytic formula, which is only approximate. Now, that's a very bad thing to do. So you shouldn't take the curves beyond X equal 1 seriously. But okay, so now what you see then is that around article 3m, or roughly here, that the S of S is becoming greater than 1/2, which means that in the static frame, not the freely falling frame, but the static frame, which of course is perfectly valid at article 3m, is the net energy in the energy flow is a negative energy going in rather than positive energy going out. Now, that transition happens closer to the horizon for spin 1, but it's still, you know, a microscopic distance away. And now, what might be a more reasonable extrapolation is to just have these, instead of plunging to minus infinity, sort of going to zero as you get well inside the black hole, which would mean that you then have all outgoing radiation with locally positive energy, but it's inside the event horizon, and so the gravitational binding energy is more negative than the positive local energy, and the there's a net negative energy. And that's the standard lore for the Hawking partners, which are the, you know, think of the Hawking radiation as the particle creation process, thinking of locally positive energy particles inside the black hole and going radially outward in the, but relative to the local really falling frames. And but of course going inward absolutely in radius because they're trapped surfaces and all, everything in the future light cone has to go in. Okay, so so again, so this is just summing up the lessons I take from these results. And just pointing out again this sensitivity to the choice of frame. The now the fact that you have negative energy, sort of negative energy flows extending well out, you know, out to the order of article 3m, and only, you know, gradually tapering off beyond that, is to me an indication that the quantum correlations that create the Hawking radiation are non-local. In other words, you can't think of a Hawking particle as being created right at the event horizon. It's really created, it's, you have, you know, sort of an evolution of the vacuum, this under vacuum modes, which gets stretched and distorted by the geodesic deviation in the vicinity of the horizon. And you can start really thinking of those modes as particles only when you get sort of R greater than 3m or so.
What about vacuum polarization? I mean, would you want to interpret all, you know, some of the properties of the sensor?
So part of this residual, what I call the residual, could be considered vacuum polarization. Or of course, then you have the conformal anomaly, but this, in a sense, kind of vacuum polarization. So you know, I don't. So in terms of how you interpret this residual part, which is associated with Hawking radiation, but not purely radial or either ingoing or outgoing radial, and its propagation is, you know, part of that you might think of as some kind of vacuum polarization. Now, so this is a major reason why I don't think pair creation, thinking of a Hawking particle is being created infinitesimally or within a few point lengths of the horizon is really a correct picture. If you believe these semi-classical results, it seems to me there's a real conflict.
So I think this at least has been appreciated by some of us, but you still produce, you know, ultimately entangled pairs.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And the interior exit.
Yeah, so you have eventually.
It only emerges when they reach scale of order the size of the
but, horizon. Yeah, so once you get well away from the horizon, then you have things you can definitely think of particle particles going out, which are entangled with Hawking partners going in, right? At least in the sense of going to smaller radius. Now, and you can, from the value, again, I can extract only really from the way the numerical results are presented. I can really only extract this constant d for spin zero. But even for spin zero, it turns out that there's enough of an angular spread that much of the radiation is coming from near the outer part of the black hole shadow, right? Which, and so it's not all this way, but in any sense. And again, as I pointed out, the part of the energy minister associated with the conformal anomaly strongly dominates near the horizon and possibly also into the horizon, you know.
But shadow, you mean out at something like 3R or something like that?
Well, yeah, so, right, so the, you know, 5M or, you know, radius of the shadow, roughly.
But, how dependent is that on your assumption about the conformal anomaly? Energy. You made an assumption about it.
Yeah, right. Well, what I'm assuming is that is dynamically uncorrelated with the Hawking radiation, which, you know, the Hawking radiation is strongly state dependent. I mean, if you take a Hartle Hawking vacuum or under vacuum, you get very different results from the Hawking radiation. And the conformal anomaly is independent of the quantum state, and it just depends on the background geometry. And so, given that, and if you also assume that that the energy tensor associated with the formula should not have a natural rest frame, which means P sub R has to be minus the energy density, then that determines the energy tensor.
That's a cosmological constant.
Well, okay, now let's talk about back reaction now. So we have this semi-classical energy momentum tensor. Now we can try to use that energy momentum tensor as a source in the Einstein equations to calculate a correction to the geometry to first order. I'm going to do that. I want to do that both outside and inside the black hole. So we need to use coordinates which are not singular on the event horizon. So find very natural to choose these Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. So V is constant on ingoing radial null geodesics, and R is the usual Schwarzschild R. And the metric then is, in general, has this form. And this quantity A, which is in terms of this what's called Misner-Sharp mass function defined for circle symmetry, that A equals 0 or 2m over R equal 1 is by definition an apparent horizon at any place where that's true. And now the Einstein equations in these coordinates are remarkably simple. The derivative at constant R with respect to the advanced time is just related to the T sub D super R component of the energy momentum tensor, and the derivative at vector R at constant advanced time is given in terms of the T V D component, and the radial derivative of psi is given in terms of the T sub R super B component, and that component, as you can see from these relations, is non-zero only if there's an outgoing component to the energy flux. As long as the energy flux is purely ingoing, whether it's positive or negative energy, as long as it's purely ingoing, then you know, corresponds to flow of energy inward, not and no component outward, then the T sub V, sub R super V is zero, and the psi is just zero, and you have a very simple measured momentum tensor. And that's going to be the basis of my analytic ansatz. Okay, now, so those are the equations, and now what you can see from those easily is that outside the horizon, dmdv is independent of R. In other words, the energy conservation requires the divergence of the energy flux vanish, and dmdv is just so the fact that you have that divergence of the energy flux zero tells you that dmdv is independent of R. It's not zero, but it's independent of R. Which tells you that the metric outside stays to a good approximation Schwarzschild as the black hole evaporates, assuming this first order approximation is valid. And that's, you know, a standard result. Inside the horizon, the only thing you know is the conformal anomaly, because that just depends on the background curvature. It doesn't depend on the state or anything else. So that's all you know. There are no calculations of the rest of the energy momentum tensor inside the horizon. But just taking this standard semi-classical conformal anomaly, you see that it starts modifying geometry, not by a small amount, but by a substantial amount, when R gets less than the one-third root of NP squared M, which is when the curvatures become coming Planckian. You know, it's a radius which is highly super, you know, it's much larger than the Planck radius, but the curvature is Planckian when that R is equal to NP squared M to the one-third. Hawking radiation, and so since near the vicinity of the outer horizon, the approximation seems to remain extremely well satisfied as long as M is large compared to the Planck mass. It's 10 to the minus 70, the first order corrections are 10 to the minus 77 initially, and then as the black hole evaporates, it gets larger, but until you get down near the Planck scale, it's still very small. So you expect the Hawking radiation to continue as long as the mass is larger than the Planck mass. Now, the entanglement entropy between the Hawking partners and the Hawking radiation quanta in the exterior becomes equal to the Bechstein-Hawking entropy at what's called the page time, which is at over m cubed over m Planck squared. So relative to the dynamical time of m, it's very large time, but it is the finite time. And you know, as far as the semi-classical approximation goes, it looks like the black hole should just keep on evaporating past that point, which means its entanglement entropy gets bigger, its Bechstein Hawking entropy gets smaller because its mass is decreasing, and that would seem to violate this understanding that the Bechstein Hawking entropy is the maximum possible entanglement entropy. And that's basically the information paradox. You have Hawking radiation, which is apparently thermal. It's entangled with the Hawking partners inside the black hole, but it's not entangled with itself, as far as the semi-classical approach goes. And so it looks like the black hole, if the black hole evaporates completely, then you end up, started with a zero entropy pure state, you end up with a highly thermal, high entropy thermal state, right? In terms of the radiation that's come out. And while you might argue that you can have a Planck scale remnant, then that leads to various issues with, you have small energy objects with enormous quantum degrees of freedom, you should expect those to be created in huge abundance at near the universe or something. So, anyway, that's the basic paradox, of course. This is well known. So how do you get around this paradox? Well, Again, this is huge literature in this over the last 40 years. And there are various categories, not a complete list by any means, but so we can either just accept the loss of unitarity in the violation of the Bechstein-Hocking entropy bound. You can try to argue that for some mechanism for acausal propagation of quantum information from inside the black hole to the outside, and Steve is
not acausal.
Well, you can argue about that, but anyway.
Those two statements are related by the symmetries of Minkowski space, which you don't have in the black hole background.
Well,
anyway,
as long as this semi-classical picture of having a semi-classical geometry is concerned, you do have locally Minkowski space, right?
And but you don't have to have macroscopic acausality.
Well, okay. Fine. I mean, I'm not saying all these things are wrong necessarily. It's just, it seems to me they require rather special arguments, which certainly extend quantum field theory in strange ways, right?
Yeah,
okay. So you have fuzzballs, propagation of quantum information being stored on a stretched horizon. Now the geodesics in the semi-classical geometry, the radial geodesics, diverge away from the outer horizon. So that would seem to indicate any quantum information that's present near the horizon is either goes off to infinity or falls into the black hole. And I think that's a very reasonable statement about what happens. So if you want to preserve unitarity and still have the black hole evaporate past the page time, then you need some way of getting quantum information out, and that has to start happening at the page time, and then you get into the problems with firewalls and so on. And I don't see more about that. So now this is my preferred way out, which is to say that the standard semi-classical calculations of the instrument tensor assume, as I said, assume that the only contribution to the trace is the conformal anomaly. Now, general relativity is not conformally invariant as a classical theory. So that suggests the possible there could be additional contributions, quantum back reaction contributions to the trace besides the conformal anomaly. Now I'm going to require that those get really large, but at least there's, a thinking out there.
So does this come from field theory, or is this really a new ingredient?
No, this is new physics. I mean, this, I'm saying some sort of new physics. This is my version of the new physics, okay? Okay. Now, so if this quantum back reaction get big enough, so you really modify this space-time geometry near the outer apparent horizon, not just deep inside the black hole, then in such a way as to get rid of the trapped surfaces, then the Hocking partner in quantum information can escape, and you can restore unitarity in the sense of a unitary S-metric. But there's no event horizon in that case.
Right? This is not a G effect, G-squared effect. Something you'd see perturbatively?
Well, you obviously can't do that perturbatively, right? But
are you predicting something that someone else might see in perturbation theory, or are you predicting a new?
So I'm not saying you can dry that by perturbation theory. You need to use quantum gravity in some much deeper and more essential way.
New physics.
New physics. That
which I have no idea about how to do, but.
And so saying, it only occurs here.
What?
It only occurs in black hole.
Well, no, it might occur in other contexts too. But
for example, let's take one example. The fuzzball people would say there's something that looks like an effective stress tensor, that extends somewhere outside the horizon of a certain size, and modifies the geometry.
Right, so the fuzzball.
Thinking of something of a comparable size or something.
But the fuzzball people would say inside the horizon, you don't have a space-time, right?
Well, even outside.
Or even outside to some extent. It's some stringy, grainy thing, right?
It's something else, but.
Something else.
You might describe that as having an effective stress.
So that's, you know, a possible point you can take. My point of view is I'm going to try to stick with the, what I call quasi-classical, because I'm not assuming it's a first order perturbation from a classical background, but still is basically a classical space-time with quantum fluctuations in sort of a non, in modifying things in a very nonlinear way.
What I'm asking, maybe you can tell us, is roughly what is the size of the new stress sensor?
Well, so, you know, so I'll show you, but, you know, it's definitely, it's not of order n pi squared over m squared. it's of order one, so. Okay. Now, as the first step, I'm going to talk about non-singular black holes. This is something that actually I first did going back in 68, I guess. So I would argue that a necessary condition for this scenario to have any chance of success is that, or a lot of scenarios to have any chance of success, is that the collapse that forms the black hole cannot result in a singularity, because if quantum information gets caught up in that singularity, by definition of singularity, you've lost the ability to predict the future, and you've lost, in some sense, unitarity. So what I'm going to assume that is, and this is not, of course, the only possible way of getting around that, is that what you end up after the initial collapse is a small non-singular core to the black hole, which is bounded by an inner apparent horizon. So you have trapped surfaces from the outer apparent horizon down to some small radius, large Planck radius, which, where the curvature is essentially starting to get close to Planck in. And that you have an inner apparent horizon, and inside that you have no trap surfaces, and r equals zero is just, you know, locally flat. Now, this is an assumption. People have argued about this. Now, if you assume that the conformally anomaly, the semi-classical form anomaly, as a form, is expand that to first order in terms of the correction, and then just do a non-singular extrapolation. So you take 1 minus x and write it as 1 over 1 plus x, right, basically. Then you get this sort of form for this mass function, where it's clearly regular. The energy density is finite at r equals zero, and it's de Sitter-like. In other words, m goes as r cubed over a squared for small r less than r cubed less than this 2a squared m, and Schwarzschild-like as for r large compared to that.
So how much more time did you need?
So m is a parameter which.
How much more time did you need for the talk since we're?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, what time? Yeah, right. So I'll try to rush through. So m is another 5 or 10 minutes or something. So m is a parameter which is roughly the Schwarzschild mass of the associated with the outer apparent horizon. And so people have talked about this form for various perspectives.
But just to be clear, the curvature inside the inner horizon is all Planckian in this model.
Well. So if A is Planckian, in other words, A is the order of the Planck light, then the curvature is, well, in the inner apparent horizon, which is at roughly at R equal A, is Planckian just as a radius, and the curvature is also Planckian.
Okay, that's your starting point for it. Yeah.
So I'm going to argue that as things evolve, that changes, but, well, that's the extrapolation. So that what most of these people do is just take A to be associated with the something sort of taken from the semi classical results, which is a word of the point length, right? I'm going to argue A is, should be actually larger than that. And this is where the Busso covariant entropy bound comes in. Because basically, the Busso bound says that, well, particularly if, say you have a closed space like two surface, which can be, in my case, a sphere inside the black hole, and you take an orthogonal null sheet of orthogonal null geodesics, which in my case I'm going to be taking the ingoing radial null geodesics going inside that two surface, that the Fournier entry of everything sort of crossing that null surface, or in a sense living in the crossing the null surface really, that von Neumann entropy has to be less than the area of the black hole, area not of the black hole, but of that two surface in Planck units. And now, so what I'm going to argue is that if we have this inner apparent horizon, then the original star that collapses is going to be, its remains are going to be inside that inner apparent horizon. The Hawking partners, if they fall in as sort of locally positive energy things, means they're radially outgoing as they can be, and they end up sort of asymptoting to the inner apparent horizon if it's null. Now, so just after the horizon, if you take, just after the collapse, if you assume it ends up as this in the square structure, then you and take a two-sphere, which is just outside the inner apparent horizon, or either on or just outside, then the entropy quantum information in the collapsing star has to be less than the area of the apparent horizon. So that points a minimum to the area of that apparent horizon for a given amount of quantum information. As the Hawking radiation proceeding, Hawking partners accumulating, you have larger and larger entropy, and by the page time, the entropy inside the inner apparent horizon, or just outside it, is essentially the Maxine-Hawking entropy. Now, if you apply Busso's covariant entropy bound, that tells you that the area of the inner apparent horizon has to be equal to the area of the outer apparent horizon.
I'm confused about the talk. So Busso said, take a two-surface, look at future-directed null.
Well, yeah, I'm talking about future-directed, but ingoing.
So ingoing future-directed ones. Yeah. Okay. And then he gets a bound on the two-surface back in the past, and that you started with, on the area.
Right.
But so now you say you take your two-surface, you look at your bound, you want Hawking partners to cross this, getting some entropy, but then the original sphere, you can't conclude the original sphere has gotten bigger in the future. I mean, you're getting
It's not the original sphere. I mean, it's just the radius of the inner apparent horizon. I don't know what you mean by a sphere. It's the radius of the inner apparent horizon has to expand to accommodate the increasing von Neumann entropy that's accumulating.
If you're saying there's a quarter of the black hole putting a lot of information into it, if you want to satisfy area, it has to get bigger to store all the information.
Right. Yeah. So, you may not believe that's true. I mean, there's no proof that's true.
Could you draw a picture of this and show us what the surface B is and what the two areas you're comparing are?
Okay, so.
I once believed something like this could be true. Yeah,
well, so.
Do we have a light on the way through this one?
We have a light on.
So
that's actually over there just by
So if you have
just behind that other two.
All right, so I'm going to draw sort of a maybe I should go on just a little bit because I have a diagram in the which okay. So I'm just saying that now the Busso, so if you believe that the Busso bound really says something non-trivial about quantum gravity, then I think it's reasonable to apply it in this situation. you believe it's just something that you only prove through sort of classical or limited application, measurable quantum back reaction type situations, then it doesn't apply. Outside that, then of course, then none of this would follow. Okay, so this is basically a schematic diagram, not to scale or anything. Of what happens. So I'm assuming that you have, say, this green line is a collapsing shell which forms a black hole. And then there's sort of almost a singularity here, but somehow it's avoided. And now this is red curve is a growing inner apparent horizon. The outer curve, if we go over a long enough time, would be gradually drifting inward. Here the diagonal lines are lines of constant advanced time, and vertical lines are lines of constant circle radius. So to the extent you neglect the decay, mass loss of the outer apparent horizon, this is the vertical line at 2m, and then these brown lines are the trajectories of outward radial multidesic. So we have the idea is that as the Hawking radiation, you're creating a pair which as particles start outside and inside the horizon by microscopic amounts, the outer one just goes off to infinity, the inward comes in, and then because it is forced inward by the trap, well, the fact you have trapped surfaces, but as it crosses this inner apparent horizon, can only cross vertically, which means that this inner apparent horizon has to be space-like. But the radius of the inner apparent horizon grow basically is saying that it's space-like, not null.
By the way, that's your version of non-locality, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree this involves, in a sense, some sort of quantum non-locality, but okay, so. So the Hawking partners can, if this interparent horizon is space-like, of course it's almost null, but if it's, then the Hawking partners can cross the interparent horizon. As they do so, their energy parameters change from being negative to positive, and so they end up with positive energy part. Well, they're positive, locally positive energy, but their energy parameters relative to infinity are positive, unless they can inside the interparent horizon. So, okay, so then now we have to argue how does this happen? I mean, and this is a toy model which just not meant to be realistic or well-founded particularly, but it's something which describes this in a coherent way. So I'm going to take this Hayward form, of the non-singular black hole metric, and I'm going to say that M is decreasing with advanced time as a result of Hawking evaporation. A is increasing with advanced time as the result of the Musso-Baum arguments. But they're just functions of advanced time, they're not functions of radius. Now that's certainly a crude approximation, really a valid approximation, but it's a crude toy model. And then you apply saying that the Hawking partners are accumulating inside the, or on the interapparent horizon, that tells you what the derivatives of M and A squared are with respect to advanced time. And then you can calculate the components of the in the advanced setting, calculate the energy momentum tensor from the assuming that in the circular metric psi is zero, so there's only ingoing radiation, and little m, the mass function is given by that simple formula. You get something which has an energy flux which is positive, but it's ingoing, so that means there's a negative energy density equal to the energy flux in magnitude given by this expression. Part of which the alpha term is what you expect from the Hawking radiation, which is the decrease in M. The beta term is the F and beta are just coefficients of order unity. And this second term is what you get from taking this toy model and assuming it's, you know, it's evolves according to the Bissell covariant bound. And the energy density you see is TVV is more or less the energy density, and it's positive. But what happens as A gets bigger is that the energy density gets smaller in magnitude. So you started maybe with a large energy density in a very small core. You end up with a smaller energy density inside a big core, right? And it's, you know, a perfectly non-singular geometry. Now what happens as you reach the page time is that the inner apparent horizon, the outer apparent horizon, I'll just skip this, talking about the outer. So what's the end game? Well, as the inner apparent horizon expands and if you assume it just, you know, when it becomes comparable to the outer apparent horizon in radius, any sort of semi-classical sort of approximation is out the window, right? You have to solve quantum gravity to figure out what really goes on. So these are just conjectures about possible endpoints. So one is that the inner and outer horizons merge and disappear, right? So the trapped surfaces go away. The trapped information is free to escape. There's no event horizon, and unitary all the way. Now another possibility is that the inner and outer horizons, because as you get close to a degenerate horizon, that is when the inner and outer horizons are at the same radius, they're degenerate, and that means the Hawking temperature is zero. So the Hawking radiation turns off as you approach, two horizons approach each other. So it's not clear that they would, because if you think, you know, the expansion of the inner horizon is driven by entanglement, if entanglement stops increasing because the Hawking radiation stops, then it's not clear, you know, that you would end up getting rid of the horizons completely. So you could end up with a approximately degenerate horizon, a massive remnant, and just sitting there, getting a large entropy, of corresponding to a mass of about half the original mass of the black hole, and zero Hawking, you know, not radiating anything more, no Hawking radiation. Now, you can argue about whether or not, in what sense, that violates unitarity. I don't think time to do that. And then the third option is that you end up in this sort of asymptotically degenerate horizon, but because the quantum information trapped inside tends to pile up just inside the inner apparent horizon, which is now just inside the outer apparent horizon, maybe through some, you know, quantum slightly non-local, you know, infection in quantum field theory, that could leak out. In other words, the Hawking partners could leak out maybe gradually over some long time, and gradually the black hole could shrink down, maintaining its sort of degenerate horizon, and eventually get down to the Planck scale and disappear, but having lost all its quantum information in the process. And so that's the basic scenario and scenarios. Now, there's alternative A, so if you draw a Penrose diagram, so if you have a shell that you have this region of trapped surfaces, and then you have the Hawking radiation, the Hawking partners actually coming out sort of in this diagram almost on top of each other, because they both, most of them come out at a single sort of retarded time here. And here you have just blast space, and here you have, say, whatever was inside the shell and leaking through this interapparent horizon, coming out at some later time. So I don't think this is, Penrose diagrams are not very useful on this game, but anyway, so to sum up, I'm saying that the generation of Hawking radiation involves macroscopic Korn correlations, which if you want to argue in some sense violates locality, then you can't. But that it's not happening at the Planck scale near the horizon. And a large black hole formed by gravitational collapse should not be viewed as a thermal state of Hawking temperature, because the actual von Neumann entry of the black hole is until you reach the page time is very small compared to the next night Hawking entropy. And anyway, so that's there. And so what I'm mentioning approach is that you should consider a large black hole as something that's basically classical. It's just described by basically the classical spacetime, but with this interaction with quantum fields modifying the spacetime. And so the black hole is a region which has trapped surfaces, but not necessarily an event horizon. And quantum fields that live in this spacetime modify the geometry. But because you're talking about enormous numbers of modes of these quantum fields contributing to the entry and to the back reaction, presumably, it's not clear that, you know, any one of these modes is only a small perturbation on this classical geometry, but the cumulative effect is large. But again, this is not exhausting quantum configurations that might exist in a fundamental theory of quantum gravity, such as string theory and so on. You might have quantum configurations which are quite different from this, corresponding to fuzz balls or firewalls or what have you. But I would argue that those are not those quantum states are not states which are compatible with initial Minkowski vacuum before the collapse of the black hole. That's my basic argument. Okay, well, thank you. Sorry.
So, just one comment on this, for example, non-locality discussion. I actually considered a scenario very much like this back in 1992.
Right.
And I've now evolved to the viewpoint where, you know, this is a more radical version of non-locality than what is needed, mm-hmm. and that there's a less radical version possibly that could accomplish the same thing. So that's filling in a little bit more of your energy.
Okay. No, I mean, certainly, I don't claim this is the last word. Any other questions or comments?
So is negative energy flowing across the inner apparent horizon? That's why it's there.
Right. So your need for this to expand the inner apparent horizon, actually, so you can say the Hawking partners may have locally positive energy and are going locally outward, but you need an ingoing negative energy, which is associated with whatever is enforcing the Busso bound, basically, is you have this additional term in the energy flux, right, which is very large compared to the Hawking partner contribution. When you're for a black hole, well below before the page time, and so. I think that is required, and you know, it's a question of can you just divide from quantum gravity and some more.
Okay.
again, it's a big stress tensor propagating, or change to the stress tensor propagating in a space like fashion. That's the, it is part of the comment that that's a, big alteration of usual physics.
Well, yeah, I mean, these quantum correlations, which are creating this engine M tensor, are doing so in a way, well, they're evolving from, causally from a quantum state, initial quantum state, but the changes are correlated, but they're not causally correlated. I mean, the changes, say, in the, at the outer parent horizon in this inner core are happening in a correlated way, but as a result of being set up by your initial state, but you can't think of one causing the other, right?
Well, but I'm just saying that the new stress tensor you assume, the whatever it comes to, the new stress tensor you assume is A, big, and B, the place where it's a big departure propagates in the space like fashion you get outside of the outside of the horizon.
Well, of course, the entanglement that I assume the entanglement is creating this ambient tensor, and you can.
Well,
if you really want to speculate, you can say, well, hierarchical the EPR, and the entanglement between the Hawking radiation particles and the Hawking partner particles involves some sort of microscopic wormholes, which sort of polarize the space-time foam of quantum gravity in such a way as to generate this interferometer tensor. And so the quantum correlations are created when the Hawking radiation is created, but then they extend over larger and larger regions, both inside and outside the black hole, as the result of the evolution of the Hawking radiation and the Hawking partners.
Any other questions?